We're in Daniel chapter 11, and as I mentioned last week, Daniel chapters 10 through 12 are one vision that Daniel receives concerning a prophecy concerning the last days. Chapter 10, we were introduced to the heavenly messenger that came to Daniel and is preparing to tell him this prophecy, which we're going to be looking at primarily tonight. If you back up into chapter 10, into verse 14, this is the heavenly messenger that's speaking to Daniel, Daniel 10:14. He says, "Now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days." For the vision refers to many days yet to come. So he's telling us what the message is going to be about. It's concerning his people, the children of Israel, and it's concerning the future and going all the way up to the very end to the latter days. Now, I'm going to give you an outline of chapter 11 just so you know where we're going before we get started. In verses 1 and 2 of chapter 11, he's going to talk about Medo-Persia. Now, in the beginning of chapter 10, it says it's the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So the Persians have just taken over the Babylonian Empire. So verse 2 is going to be talking about the Medo-Persians, and then in verse 3, it's going to be talking about Alexander the Great and his Greek Empire. Then in verse 4, it's going to speak about the four generals that Alexander the Great's empire was divided up among. And then in verses 5 through 20, it's going to talk about the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, those in Egypt and those in Syria. It's two areas that two of the four generals had after Alexander the Great, and it's going to cover 130 years of them battling it out together. And it's very specific in what it's saying, but yet it's very vague in who it's talking about. It just says the king of the north against the king of the south, and he came against him, and then he came against him, and you have about 15 verses that cover that. So that's a historical thing from our perspective. It was future from Daniel's perspective when it was given. But then in verses 21 through 35, it focuses in on one of those Seleucid kings, Antiochus Epiphanes, and 11 years of his reign. He's the one that persecuted the people of God in Jerusalem. He's the one that desecrated the temple, and it was the cleansing of that temple that brought about the celebration of Hanukkah that's still celebrated today. And then in verses 36 and following, it telescopes to the latter days and speaks of a ruler that is yet to come. John refers to him as the Antichrist. And Antiochus is a type of the Antichrist in that Antiochus Epiphanes persecuted the people of God. He desecrated the temple, and that's what we'll see, or what will be seen in the last days with the Antichrist, verses 36 to 45. One commentator has said there are as many as 130 predictions in these 35 verses before us. So there's a lot of detailed prophecy from the point it was given. And I'll just say this, so much so that critics of the book of Daniel criticize the book of Daniel largely because of this chapter right here in saying it's got to be written after the fact because it's so specific on what it's talking about. And that's really a testimony to the nature of prophecy that God knows the end from the beginning and has spoken that through his heavenly messenger to his prophet Daniel. So we're going to back up a little bit into chapter 10 just as we set the stage getting into the message. Let's take it up from chapter 10. Verse 20, where we read, "Then he said," that is the heavenly messenger said to Daniel, "Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed, the prince of Greece will come." And last week we talked about the spiritual warfare that we get the insight into in Daniel chapter 10, how this heavenly messenger was battling it out with the prince of Persia. And as we looked at from our passage, it had to have been an angelic being, in this case, a fallen angelic being, that this heavenly messenger was battling with. And then he's saying here, the prince of Greece will come. And we talked about how the leaders of the world are influenced, whether good or bad, by good or bad heavenly messengers, how there are angelic beings, Michael the Archangel being one of them, that are positively influencing and even protecting the people of God. But then you have fallen angels or demons, as the Bible speaks of it, that are negatively influencing rulers of the world. And that's why it's so important for us to be praying for the leaders in our country, and also recognizing that in the rulers of the world. And so verse 21, it goes on to say, "But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth." And that's setting up the message that is yet to come here in chapter 11. And then parenthetically, the angelic messenger says, "No one upholds me against these, the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece to come, except Michael, your prince." And we talked about Michael the archangel being the one who was overseeing Daniel's people. And so many commentators look at Michael as the guardian angel of Israel, specifically set apart to watch out for them. Then as we come into chapter 11, he continues on with the thought, "Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." In the first year of Darius the Mede, who is a ruler over the Medo-Persian Empire, the angelic messenger says, "I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." Now, the "him" is either Darius the Mede or it's Michael the Archangel. So he's either saying, "I was there to stand up and strengthen this human ruler," or he's saying, "Just like Michael helped me out, in chapter 10, I want to let you know, a couple years ago, I helped him out as well." So I really don't know, but as we're finishing that parenthetical thought, I wanted to make the point that the Persians were used by God to allow the children of Israel to go back to their national homeland. It was when Cyrus the Persian came into power that he allowed them to go back and to begin to rebuild their temple and begin to repopulate the land of Israel once again. And so you have got a picture of what's taking place in the spiritual realm, behind the scene, if you will, what's taking place with the influences of these angelic messengers. This Darius that's being referred to in chapter 11 is the one we read about in chapter 6 who was duped into calling the decree that sent ultimately Daniel into the lion's den. And it was this Darius that didn't want to do it, but because of the laws of the Medes and the Persians, he couldn't change the decree he made that ultimately sent Daniel into the lion's den. Now, I think it's interesting, in light of talking about angels and how they protect the people of God, it's interesting to remember that the next morning when Darius the king came to the lion's den and cried out, "Oh, Daniel, has your God saved you?" Daniel's reply was, "My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth." It's kind of interesting in light of our study through chapter 10. So here in verse 2, he says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." So this is the message that concerns Daniel's people, and it concerns things that are yet to come. So they're at the beginning of the Persian Empire, and he says three more kings are going to come. Historically, that was Cambyses in 529 BC, Pseudo-Smyrnus in 522 BC, and Darius Hystaspes in 521 BC. The fourth was Xerxes, who is the Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther, the fourth one that's mentioned here in verse 2. Middle of verse 2, "The fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." Xerxes, who invaded Greece in 480 BC, was defeated, and never again did Medo-Persia make a bid for world dominion. You know, as you go through this, again, it's very, from our vantage point, it's very historical. The commentary that I saw that really dug into it and pulled out the individuals, as we're going to see tonight in a very thorough way, was J. Vernon McGee, which I thought was quite interesting. And again, he was quite good and quite thorough in doing that. So we're going on a little history lesson here tonight as we go through this, okay? In verse 3, it talks about a mighty king. It says, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. After the Medo-Persian Empire came the Greek Empire. The mighty king that's in reference here is Alexander the Great. He came to power in 335 BC over the Greco-Macedonian Empire, and he put down Persia and assumed world dominion. Verse 4 says, and when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. Now, this is in reference to Alexander's four generals. J. Vernon McGee writes, Alexander the Great was a world ruler and probably the greatest military strategist the world has ever seen, but he died an alcoholic in 323 BC. He conquered the world, but he wasn't satisfied. He was still searching for something. The four generals that his kingdom was broken up under was Cassander, who took Macedonia, which that would be in the green, that's present-day Greece. And then Lysimachus took Asia Minor, that would be modern-day Turkey. And then Seleucus Nicator took Syria, and if you notice, the remainder of the Middle East. And then Ptolemy took Egypt, and all four families would war among themselves. His kingdom divided up among four generals. This corresponds to some of the visions that Daniel had in Daniel chapter 8, where Daniel saw a goat with a notable horn, but then the horn was broken and four notable horns came up out of that, would correspond with this right here. The goat represents, as it tells us in Daniel 8, the kingdom of Greece, that notable horn being the first king, Alexander the Great, or the prominent king. And then after he is broken, after his death, the four horns being the four generals that come up. Daniel 8:8, we'll zero in on that. Also in Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel has the dream or the vision of the beast that take place, the leopard that had the four heads would correspond with Greece and the four generals that it would be broken up amongst. Now, eventually, these guys all lost their kingdom, and it would be overtaken by Rome. And so this is the picture of what things looked like, if you will, from Greece until the Romans came, divided up among the four generals. What we're going to be looking at next in these next 15 verses is the king of the north and the king of the south battling it out, and that's going to be the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, or basically the area of, if you will, zeroing it down, Egypt and Syria, much larger than that, but you get the idea. And as they would battle it out, check this out, as one would overtake the other and gain a little more ground, look at the people group that is being affected as they enlarge their borders. It's the nation of Israel. So when they go to attack each other, they're going through the nation of Israel, and they're the ones that the Israelis are the ones that are suffering at the hands of either the Seleucids or the Ptolemies. And this makes us understand why there's such persecution that comes upon them. As we're going to see, the Seleucid king is going to go down, and he's going to not get what he wants in Egypt. And so when he goes back home, he takes it out on the Jewish people. And there is where the persecution comes against them. Okay, so this is what we're going into as we look at these kings over a 130-year period. Ptolemy the First of Egypt is what we're going to be looking at as we start into verse 5. And I put together just this little family tree so that you can keep track of where we're going and who we're talking about as we go through this over a century bit of history between the kings of the north and the kings of the south. Okie doke. So we'll take it a verse at a time and make some comments as we go through. In verse 5, it says, also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Ptolemy the First of Egypt exerts his control over Israel and is the major power in the area. One of his princes, Seleucus the First, also rises to power and takes power over the region of Syria. He would eventually become more powerful than his former Egyptian ruler. They and their descendants would fight each other for some 130 years. The stronger of the two always had rights to Israel. verse 6. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Ptolemy II, as we follow the chart, sends his daughter Bernice to marry Antiochus II. So the daughter of the king of the south sends his daughter to marry the king of the north. She shall not retain the power of authority. Once Ptolemy II died, Antiochus II put away Bernice and took back his former wife, Laodice. But Laodice still didn't trust Antiochus II, so she had him poisoned and had Bernice, her attendants, and an infant son of Antiochus II killed, and she puts her son Seleucia II on the throne. It's the making of a soap opera. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the family tree of Herod the Great, because they had quite the issues going on with them. Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. Ptolemy III avenges his sister Bernice's death. Ptolemy III was the branch of her roots, Bernice's roots, which arose after the death of Ptolemy II. Ptolemy III invaded Syria and humbled Seleucus II, but when Ptolemy III went back to Egypt, Seleucus II regained much of his former territory. Ptolemy III lived 4 years past Seleucia II. Verse 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Verse 10, referring to Seleucus III and Antiochus III. These were the two sons of Seleucia II and were both successful generals. Seleucia III ruled only a short time and was succeeded by his brother. Verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Referring to Ptolemy IV getting engaged, Antiochus III takes back Israel, but is defeated at Raphia. He gives it all back to Ptolemy IV. Verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south, also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. Again, remember what we're following is 130 years of these generations battling it out with one another. Verses 13 through 16, in reference to Antiochus III invading again, gaining final control over Israel, over the armies of Ptolemy V. In Israel, Antiochus III was helped by Jews who were resentful of the Egyptian rule and was welcomed as a liberator into Jerusalem, but Jewish partisans failed to gain lasting benefit for their people. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. Antiochus III gives his daughter Cleopatra to Ptolemy V in hopes of permanent influence in Egypt. She was specifically Cleopatra I, the ancestor of the famous Cleopatra who would live some 100 years later. But Cleopatra I disappointed her father by being very faithful to Ptolemy V and to Egypt. Verse 18, after this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many. But a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. After regaining Israel, Antiochus III turns his attention to the Greek coastlands. He was eventually turned back by a Roman ruler, Lucius Cornelius Scipio. His inglorious end, needing money for the treasury badly, he resorted to pillaging a Babylonian temple and was killed by enraged local inhabitants. Verse 20, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. The brief reign of Seleucus IV, the eldest son of Antiochus III, Antiochus III's son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, heavily taxed his people to pay Rome, but he was poisoned, destroyed not in battle, by his treasurer, Heliodorus. Now we come in verse 21 to Antiochus Epiphanes. So we went through about 130 years of the kings of the north and the kings of the south battling it out with one another. In verse 21, it says, and in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. As we come to the bottom of the list of the king of the north, we've come to Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. He took to himself the name Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one. Here's a coin of Antiochus IV. The reverse of the coin shows Apollo enthroned. The Greek inscription means of Antiochus, God manifest, bearer of victory. This is a ruler who believed in himself. And he referred to himself as Epiphanes, Antiochus the illustrious one. But people who knew him referred to him as Epimanes, Antiochus the madman, because he was crazy in the things that he did. Now, when it says that he seizes the kingdom, he was not an heir to the throne, but rather he usurped it. It says here in verse 22, with the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. That's a reference to the high priest whose name was Onias III. And Antiochus took him out and he set up his own high priest who would Hellenize the people. In other words, who would water them down into the Greek culture. So paganizing, beginning to paganize the religion of the Jewish people. Verse 23, and after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He's doing what his fathers have not done, distributing the spoils of the people that they've conquered to all of his people. We call it today the redistribution of wealth. You see, it's not a new thing. And he was doing it to get the people on his side. And it's what we see today, too. Let's share the wealth. You know, we have in our country now this mentality of entitlement, that I deserve something free from my government. And what that does is two things. It creates a lazy populace, and it also strips a person of their self-worth. Because in our country, one of the things I think that's made America great is that we've been able to go out and work hard and be able to succeed. And when we succeed, we can not only prosper financially, but also we get the satisfaction. You know, when you step out and try something, and looking in, you know, the business world as an entrepreneur, to step out, and you know, if you don't make it, you fail. So there's a risk that you're taking. But in this country, we've had the ability to do that, to step out, and we work hard. And when we make it, not only can we be financially prosperous, but we also can have that sense of satisfaction. And that's part of what makes a country strong, is people who've got an ownership in the country, and they feel good about themselves. And I think God's created us that way, to be able to work hard and to be able to enjoy the spoils of our hard work. When you start giving people things, I think this is part of the problem within our society, and part of what we see as well within the welfare system. When you start giving people things, it not only takes away that drive to work hard, but it also robs a person of that satisfaction. And so it can really start robbing them of their self-worth, and thus the desire to really step up and work hard. In the Bible, the way God designed the welfare system to be, as we see in the law with the nation of Israel, is if a person was poor, the farmers, first of all, were instructed not to harvest the corners of their fields, but just to leave those outer edges for the poor people. And the poor people, you know, for whatever reason, you know, whatever happened that made them poor, they could go out, they wouldn't go hungry, they could go out and they could harvest up the edges of them so that they would have food. So they're getting taken care of, but in the process of it, they still have their dignity, because they're going out and they're able to get it for themselves. And I understand that there's some people who just can't do that, and those are the people that absolutely we should be reaching out to and helping. But the people who can help themselves, I think if our system was designed more like we find in God's word, we would be a stronger country because of it. And again, I think this is one of the reasons our country has been weakened so bad, is because of this concept of the redistribution of wealth. And leaders do that to get people to support them. And I think it's leading our country, and has led our country in a bad direction. So it's nothing new that's going on. This is what Antiochus Epiphanes was doing back then. So in verse 25, it says, "He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him." Verse 26, "Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time." A reference to Antiochus with a great army going against the Egyptians, doing well, but they had to sit down at the same table for a peace agreement, but they were dishonest. Again, it's nothing new, you know, what we see today. Verse 28, "While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land." As I mentioned, Israel was right in the path of these guys warring it out. "Antiochus went back with much spoil, but disappointed that he didn't conquer all of Egypt, so he took out his frustration on the Jewish people. Verse 29, "At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him." 2 years later, Antiochus came against the Egyptians again. And as he came down there, he was opposed by the Romans. From the Roman Senate, Pompilius Laenas You know, we just don't have names like that anymore, do we? I mean, the Romans really had kind of some slick names that just rolled off the tongue. From the Roman Senate, Pompilius Laenus took to Antiochus a letter forbidding him to engage in war with Egypt. When Antiochus asked for time to consider, the emissary drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus and demanded that he give his answer before he stepped out of the circle. This is the earliest origin of the metaphor of drawing a line, the phrase drawing a line in the sand. He's gone down to Egypt. Rome has sent over a delegation that says, if you go to war with Egypt, you're fighting against Rome. And so Antiochus says, can I have a little bit of time to think about it? And that's when the circle is drawn around him. You think before you get out of the circle. So this is what enraged him so much. Verse 30 again, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. When it says that he shows regard for those who forsake the covenant, these are the people who have become Hellenized, watered down in the Greek culture that are in Jerusalem. And many had forsaken the Orthodox ways and became in favor of the Greek culture. It says, forces shall be mustered by him. Antiochus attacked Jerusalem, so upset that he attacked Jerusalem as he came back from Egypt and came against them. He attacked them on the Sabbath day, a day where they wouldn't be prepared for battle, a day where many of them would not fight because it was the Sabbath day. On that day, 80,000 Jews were killed. 40,000 were taken as prisoners, and another 40,000 were sold as slaves, and he pillaged the temple. David Guzek's note says he pillaged as much as $1 billion, David Guzek's words. It says he takes away the daily sacrifices. Israel, according to their law, would offer a lamb in the morning and they would offer a lamb in the evening. This is the way that they would approach God. It would be through blood sacrifice. It was the way that their sins would be covered. There would be atonement through the shedding of blood. So as he comes and he does away with the daily sacrifices, he's basically cutting off that conduit for Israel to be able to be right with their God. So he takes away the daily sacrifices and he places there what is referred to here as the abomination of desolation. Simply put, it's a detestable thing that would cause devastation and barrenness, an abomination that caused the place to be desolate because of the persecution. The Jews couldn't stand there because of the defilement. They wouldn't stand there. And historically, what he did is he set up an altar of Zeus on the altar of burnt offering, and he had a pig offered upon the altar. Now, a pig was an unclean animal. So not only do you have a pagan god's altar that's placed in there, but you also have an unclean animal's blood that's being shed there. So it desecrated it. This was December 16th, 167 BC. The Jews were also compelled to offer a pig on the 25th day of each month to celebrate Antiochus Epiphanes' birthday. And so you can imagine, I mean, the persecution that the Jews are feeling through this. Okay, it's not just 80,000 have been killed, 80,000 have been taken as prisoners or sold as slaves, but they have desecrated this holy place where they would come and meet with their God. So it was an overwhelming thing. And again, what's referred to here as the abomination of desolation. This is what would be for Daniel's people. Remember, as we started out looking back in chapter 10. So this was prophecy from the time Daniel was getting it. From our vantage point, clearly, up to this point, it's history. We're looking back again. It was December 16th, 167 BC, that this took place. Having that in mind, you go forward approximately 200 years, and Jesus said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Notice he's not looking back, even though he's 200 years in the future. He's pointing towards the future. This is in response to his disciples saying, what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? And he says, when you see in the future the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel, pointing back to what we're looking at right here, standing in the holy place. And then it says in our passage, let him who reads understand. In other words, we put our thinking caps on and go, hey, wait a minute. This has already taken place a couple hundred years earlier. Maybe what it's saying is Antiochus and his persecution against the Jewish people is a picture of what is yet to come in the future. And so in the future, there will be another that's like Antiochus Epiphanes that will be very arrogant and will persecute the people of God and will desecrate the Jewish temple. Now, it makes it interesting from our vantage point because there is no Jewish temple right now. But there's a movement to build a temple in Jerusalem. There's a movement, and that movement will succeed, or a movement like it will succeed, because a temple will be rebuilt and it will be desecrated. And this time, the abomination of desolation, it won't be an altar, it won't be a pig, but it will be this man himself that will proclaim himself to be God, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And we'll talk about that more when we gather together next week. But it's important to see that as Jesus is referencing, he's referencing right back to the passage we're talking about. And so it opens up our mind to think and go, this in the future is going to be like what took place in the past. And in verse 21 of Matthew 24, Jesus said, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. An unprecedented time of trouble that's coming upon the earth. Remember again, the primary focus is Daniel's people. Daniel's people and the Holy Land. It's going to affect the whole world, but this all originates out of prophecies that deal with the Jewish people. God has his hand on those people. God's going to use those people. He will raise them up again. And when Jesus returns, they are going to be very prominent during the time of the kingdom age. But they're going to go through some serious persecution before that takes place. Zechariah chapter 13, again, the inference seems to be that two-thirds of them are not going to make it. So it's going to be a devastating time for them. And I really believe this is part of why it was so overwhelming to Daniel, because Daniel loves his people. And he's being told repeatedly through these visions and dreams that there's going to be some serious persecution that's going to come upon the people that you love. And we'll see that as we gather again over the next couple of weeks and close out the book. Yes? 167 B.C., December 16th. Now, I want to point out one other thing as we make our way through here. Verse 32, as we come back to that date, it says, those who do wickedly against the covenant. And remember, again, there are those that have been Hellenized that are like, the religion doesn't matter that much. We'll go along with you, Antiochus. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And this is foretelling what would take place under Judas Maccabeus, where he would come in. He was referred to as the hammerer. And he would come in and he would be able to take back Jerusalem, and they would be able to cleanse the temple. And that's the feast that's celebrated to this day. And it's known as Hanukkah. And this took place in late 164 BC. And I bring that date up, because as we went through Daniel chapter 8, and it talked about the 2,300 evenings and mornings, do you remember that? How long until this takes place? This is the time frame that commentators point to, the time frame of the desecration of the temple under Antiochus until the cleansing of it by Judas Maccabeus, who was the hammer. And the story of that, too, is, I mean, it has an air of supernatural to it, because the place has been desecrated, and they had to go through certain rituals in order to cleanse it, and it was the candelabra that the oil was enough for it to keep burning for I believe it was 8 days until they were able to ceremonially make some more and able to do that. And so they celebrate this feast that's known today as Hanukkah. It's also known as the Feast of Lights, and it's also known as the Feast of Dedication, which is neat because in John chapter 10, it says, now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. And so this isn't a feast that originated in the law, like many of the other feasts, but it was a feast day that came about because of this great deliverance that happened after the law from Judas Maccabeus. And what's neat about this is Jesus is at this feast, and yet he would be the greater deliverer who would come to deliver not only Israel, but the world from the bondage of sin. And so interesting to look at that. But as it says this right here at the end of verse 32, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. That was true back then, and it's true today. The people who know their God, God can do amazing things through their lives, through our lives. In 2 Chronicles 16:9, it says, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. And oftentimes it's in the difficulties, in the time of persecution, where the strength of the Lord comes upon the people who know their God and who love their God, and he can use them in powerful ways. And so no matter how bad times get, sometimes that is the fuel that creates the fires of persecution that enable the people of God to do great exploits and to be able to stand strong. It goes on to say here in verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall, notice this, to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. The refining work that takes place through the difficulties, through times of persecution, that's when not only our faith is tested and shown to be what it is, but also a work is done in our lives. Isn't it true that it's through the difficult things that we go through that our lives really seem to grow with the Lord? The hardships that we go through, we come out the other side of them, and there's something different about us. It's like gold being refined in the fire. It goes through the fire, and it comes out more valuable after it's been in the fire. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, speaking of this great salvation, he says, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. I know none of us wish for difficult things to come in our lives, but it's through those difficult things so oftentimes that it's then the strength of the Lord is seen through us. And for the Jewish people, they went through a lot and they will go through a lot in the days to come. The time of the end, as he says, is still for an appointed time. Now, as we come to verse 36, we start moving beyond the days of Antiochus the Fourth, and we start moving in. Remember, it's all prophecy from his vantage point. We start moving in to the time of the end, the time of the Antichrist. And guys, that's where we're going to take it up next week, okay? So let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll open it up for any questions or comments that y'all have. Father, we want to thank you for the time we could spend in your word, oh God, and just a reminder of prophecy, that it's such a testimony of the divine inspiration of Scripture, that you have told us the end from the beginning, and so that we can have such a trust in your word, and also that we can know what's going to come in the days that are ahead. And Lord, I pray again that you would just take our lives and that you would use us as light to illuminate your truth, and also as salt to make people thirsty for what they can have with you, O God. May you be blessed, I pray, in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.